Aleister Crowley was an English occultist, ceremonial magician, a poet, a painter, a novelist. He founded the religion of the Thelema, identifying himself as a prophet entrusted with guiding humanity. The British tabloids at the time called him one of the most wicked men on the planet. He died in 1947. Who was he? What was he? In a moment, Lon Milo Duquette joins us to talk about Aleister Crowley. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Lon Milo Duquette is perhaps the most visible ceremonial magician worldwide. He's also a songwriter and a curious combination of recording artist, humorist, social commentator, occultist, demonologist, entertainer. 17 books out there on all kinds of subjects. He's also a 32nd degree Freemason and International Magical Society member of the 20th century. And here he is, Lon Milo Duquette. Welcome back, Lon.
Thank you, George. We saw each other earlier this year.
We did. That was fun.
That was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. We have to do that again.
By the way, you've got a lot of energy, my friend. I'm impressed.
Well, thank you. I'm going to keep it up as long as I can.
Hey, tell me, how did you get involved with studying Aleister Crowley? Some people call him Crowley. It's Crowley, isn't it?
It's Crowley. At least he corrected people and said it rhymes with holy. So it must be Crowley. So our Ozzy Osbourne song
is wrong, huh?
Well, he mispronounces it, but it's one of my favorite songs, so it's fun to hear that. I got interested in it accidentally, because I was interested in Eastern mysticism, you know, as a 1960s psychedelic era hippie.
Yeah.
At the time, I figured that Eastern mysticism was going to be hard work, and I started to look for something that might might be easier, and I tried to find the same sort of subtlety that I enjoyed in Eastern mysticism in sort of a Western version of it, and that sort of got me into the studying the Hebrew Kabbalah and the Western applications to that, the Hermetic applications of Hebrew Kabbalah, which is like tarot cards, and that sort of got me interested in other sort of Kabbalistic-based arts and sciences, and ceremonial magic was one of those, and Aleister Crowley popped up as one of the leading figures in that whole thing, but he had such a bad reputation of being such an evil guy and everything that at first I was really spooked. And
by the way, today's his birthday.
Happy Aleister Crowley's birthday. Yes, today's his birthday, October 12th.
He'd be about 142, I guess, if my math is correct.
That's your math is correct. And
Well, he was born in England. What kind of a kid was he?
Well, he was a pretty good kid, by all indications. His dad was kind of a wealthy brewer, and he brewed Crowley ales, which they were selling right up until, you know, our time almost. And so they were sort of wealthy, but his father was a lay preacher for the Plymouth Brethren, or a branch of the Plymouth Brethren, which was an early version sort of an evangelical type Christian. And he really liked his dad a lot, according to his diaries and everything, and respected his dad, and he memorized great portions of the Bible as part of his, just, you know, growing up. That was his literature. And but his mother sort of tormented him with her sort of a very primitive understanding of that religion and that sect, and that sort of traumatized him. So in, after his father died, he was sort of a rebellious youth and kind of a sickly child. So he started, for his health, he started mountain climbing or rock climbing. And he excelled at that, and he got his health back. And he eventually became a world-class mountaineer. As a matter of fact, he's got a couple of Himalayan climbs that he still holds the record.
Who would have thought?
Who would have thought? Yeah. Yes. But he was sort of rebellious against the restrictive nature of Christianity, and he was a sensitive guy and sort of a poet at heart. And when he went off to Cambridge, he really was introduced to a broader world of poetry and art, and that eventually led him to a fascination with Kabbalah. And eventually he wound up being introduced to somebody in the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which you may or may not have be aware of. It was an influential magical society that sort of grew out of Freemasons who were interested.
Was it almost like the Illuminati of today?
Yes. If we look at the Illuminati as a benevolent organization, but it was a secret society. And Crowley really, really loved it, and he excelled through all their knowledge lectures and everything. And he was a very, very good student, but he joined the organization just at the nadir of its existence. It was getting ready to explode into schism, and so he got into it just as it was falling apart. And around 1904, he sort of struck out on his own with his magical explorations.
Would you say, Lon, that he was evil?
No, I wouldn't say he was evil at all. But
he sure got that reputation, didn't he?
You know, and I think he enjoyed letting people think he was evil if they didn't have the patience or the intelligence to know what it was he was talking about. He had a strange sense of humor. He overestimated people a lot, and magic does have it's a spiritual art form, and so it does have the colorful trappings of dealing with aspects of consciousness and personifying them as angels and spirits and demons, and it's kind of a subtle thing that uses the imagination. And if you're really stuck in sort of a very narrow spiritual worldview, that of course seems evil, because it is at odds with a lot of people's spiritual worldview. But actually, no. And as I mentioned on the TV show, as wild and crazy as it was, I consider him a bona fide holy man in his own right, but a very colorful one.
Well, he called himself the Beast 666.
Yeah,
and that's kind of weird.
Well, to a Kabbalist, that the book of the Revelation of John was written as a Kabbalistic text. It was written by a Kabbalist, and actually four Kabbalists. And so the imagery and the numbers and the association with the narrative of the book of Revelation was the writer's attempt to sort of paint a picture of the circumstances that would bring it in to the age, and the age actually being a phase of human consciousness. And so the imagery of Revelations seems pretty scary.
Mm-hmm, right.
Yeah, and but it's especially scary from the point of view of an old phase of human consciousness ending and a new phase of human consciousness beginning.
Did he claim to be the Antichrist?
Not in so many words. He did identify with the beast, and in Revelation, this pair of characters, the beast and Babylon, they go together. Okay, and believe it or not, they're both representative of very high levels of consciousness that are placed on the famous Kabbalistic diagram, the Tree of Life, as the second emanation from Godhead and the third emanation from Godhead. And that's really high stuff, but it's so high stuff that from way down here in our lower levels of consciousness, it is so outrageously different that it appears dark, it appears sinister, but in the same way as Tibetan gods have these terrible visages, okay? They're, you see paintings of Tibetan gods, and they look like horrible fire-breathing demons.
Sure.
Okay, but they're wonderful, beautiful concepts. Crowley was sort of the first Westerner that used that same subtlety of almost using the opposite symbolism and nomenclature to describe wonderful transcendent concepts. And of course, if the listener isn't attuned or prepared for that kind of subtlety of religious thought, it's going to seem very frightening and
sure.
Very evil.
Well, was Elon a Satanist, a devil worshiper?
No.
Boy, he's been, his image has really been tarnished.
No, well, it really has.
They even say he sacrificed babies.
Well, no, he didn't sacrifice babies. Of course, he didn't. And anybody that would accuse him of doing that, he would think that they were so stupid that he may as well freak them out and say, "Oh well, of course."
Well,
I did 120 times last year.
Why would he get these kinds of reputations?
First of all, I don't think he was aware at how much he was being misinterpreted by the general public. His closest disciples, his closest students, it was very clear to them what he was doing, and he was a bona fide genius. And sometimes, and I know you meet geniuses all the time, and they're very curious people.
Sure, they're different.
They're different, and they're not always socially.
That's true.
aware of their circumstances.
And they're introverted.
Right, and they insult people, and they don't even know they're insulting people, and people just don't understand them. And sometimes geniuses are so focused on their work that they can be a bit dangerous to be around, you know, as far as they make very curious friends, and you got to sort of watch yourself around them. And Crowley was sort of like that on steroids.
Did he have friends?
He always had friends, but he didn't keep them for very long. There was only a few people in his life that stayed friends with him, because sooner or later,
Well, did they dump him or did he dump them?
Both. Both. Okay. I was friends with his secretary for a number of years in the 1920s. I wasn't his friend in the 1920s. He was his secretary in the 1920s, Israel Regardie, Francis Israel Regardie. And he lived with Crowley in Europe, in several countries in Europe. He was a young man and had become interested in Crowley through his writings. He was his private secretary, and probably as close as anybody could be in that capacity. And eventually, they had a falling out over a woman. Which many times that's a very normal thing to have a falling out over.
Okay. They both chased the same woman.
That's right, or the same woman chased both of them is
right.
More like it. But Crowley became so viciously, and I can only use the word small. In the way he insulted him, and the way he belittled him, and it was absolutely despicably cruel.
So he had a mean streak.
He definitely had all sorts of character flaws that any of us would share, but when he got a hold of them. And was focusing on him for any amount of time, they became even more amplified. So he was a very, very difficult character to get along with. And to tell you the truth, I'm happy that I didn't know him personally.
Really?
Yes. Because
you don't think you would have gotten along with him?
No, I really don't. In a sense, you know, he's wonderful to read and appreciate from a distance.
There was word, Delon, that he was a German spy. Spied against the Brits where he was born.
There definitely was a rumor. And not only that, but he was a spy. But he was a spy for British intelligence.
Was he a double agent, maybe?
Yes. And in some capacities, maybe double and triple at the time. But who he was working for, he was almost comically patriotic to England, almost like a Gilbert and Sullivan character.
He was pretty well known, wasn't he?
Yes. But he was recruited at Cambridge. And there's a beautiful book written by a guy named Spence, who wrote the definitive work on the great English spy Sidney Reilly, for whom James Bond was...
portrayed as, huh?
Yeah. And he wrote a book about Crowley being a spy, and the book was called, it's still out, it's very popular.
Well, let's get into Crowley's work when we come back, Lon. We're going to hit this break, but let's get into his magic. Was he a conjurer of demons? Let's get into all of that when we come back. And welcome back to Coast, Lon Milo Duquette with us. We'll take calls with Lon next hour. We're talking about Aleister Crowley. And let's talk about his magic a little bit and his conjuring. A lot of people felt that he conjured up demons. Did he or did he not, Lon?
Well, I will have to say yes and no.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Nice political answer.
Yes, he did. But we need to understand what the nature of demons are and the nature of demons that he called up. And if I just give me a second, I'll try to lay that groundwork.
Okay, and why would he try to conjure them up? What was he trying to prove?
He was trying to, we've all got things going on in our lives that aren't going perfectly. We've got character flaws, we've got weaknesses, we've got neuroses, we've got hang-ups. If we were operating at full capacity, we wouldn't have these negative flaws or things literally attached to our character. In a sense, he would personify those flaws, those characteristics that are incomplete, unbalanced, out of control areas of his life. He would personify those as demons, and they're very, very real. They're just as dangerous as anything that you can think of, because they are things that are out of control in your life. He would personify those and through magical technique literally evoke them into his presence so he could give them new instructions, new marching orders, tell them to work for him instead of working against him. And if he can't get them to work for him, he banishes them or annihilates them from his universe. And in a sense, I don't want to make it sound like psychology, because this is a very dramatic and with spiritual dimensions, art form. But in a sense, that's just basically what it is. But in order to understand what magic is, you sort of have to come at it from the understanding of a master magician. And magic is really tied up with the field of consciousness.
Did he put spells or curses on people?
That he did not do.
He did not do that.
He did not do. There's instances where he thought that another magician, specifically McGregor Mathers, had was magically attacking him, and he took magical measures that were of a defensive nature. But Crowley always came at the practice of any of his spiritual disciplines from the idea that whatever he does not escape karma, and that the idea of purposely cursing somebody or putting a spell on somebody or causing somebody to do something that was against their will was totally alien to his philosophy.
Did he die a drug addict?
Well, he not only died a drug addict, he lived a drug addict.
He did.
Yeah,
huh?
He had.
So that's true.
He had severe asthma. Remember, I said he learned to mountain climb to get his health. Since he was a child, he had debilitating asthma. And as he grew older, especially into middle age, and of course he smoked that terrible Perique tobacco, his lungs would seize up on him, and truly he would a couple times a week nearly suffocate to death. So he was prescribed medically prescribed. Heroin, and from the time he was prescribed it in middle age till he died at 72,
he got addicted.
He got addicted. Then he would try to get off and have periods of where he was off, but then he'd have his attacks. And my friend Grady McMurtry, who visited Crowley in England, was with him. They were playing chess, and Crowley had one of his asthma attacks, and he completely stopped breathing. His lungs seized up, and it looked like he was going to fall down on the chessboard, and Grady tried to assist him, and Crowley waved him away, and he slowly walked over to the mantelpiece and got out his kit with the syringe and everything in it, and while he was not breathing, he carefully set up his syringe and injected himself, and he had not breathed in a couple of minutes, as Grady described it, and he didn't breathe until that injection kicked in. So yes, he was, but during his youth, he experimented with mind expanding psychedelics, hashish, and what today we would call peyote,
right?
And magic mushrooms, but all of it in the same way as a scientist would experiment with. Every time he took it, he got out his magical record, took copious notes of all of his experiences and the visions that he had, but of course he was doing everything that a consciousness explorer, Crowley was literally a consciousness pioneer.
Did he bring modern astrology to the West?
Yes, as a matter of fact, and this is a story that few people know. You know, astrology wasn't always a popular thing. It wasn't always in the newspapers and your sun sign and things like that. It didn't really get popular until the 1920s, when a woman named Evangeline Adams wrote two books, Your Place in the Stars and what's the other one? Your Place Among the Stars or something like that. Two books of astrology. Evangeline Adams was involved in a very famous court case where she drew the astrological chart of the judge's son and told him something incredibly insightful that...
During the court case.
During the court case. And she brought astrology into the English-speaking modern world. Well, Aleister Crowley wrote both those books. Aleister Crowley was living in New York at the time and lecturing in New York at the time. And Evangeline Adams paid Crowley, because Crowley was a very insightful and ingenious astrologer himself. And it was like a work for hire.
Did he have notoriety, Lon, wherever he went?
Pretty much so. And that was also part of his job as an intelligence agent. He was in New York to help the United States get into, or to help England get the United States into the World War I on England's side. That was his
mission. Huh?
Yeah, that was his mission, and he succeeded.
Some people called him a con man. Was he?
Well, a con man, a good con man, usually gets rich. People said he took advantage of women and took advantage of disciples, but no. He may have been somewhat of a mooch off of friends, but he sort of had to live by his wits wherever he went because he was busy starting World War I and things like that. But anyway, Evangeline Adams, her estate, just in the last 10 years, has now shared the copyrights of those books with Crowley's Literary Heirs, which is the OTO, the group, the organization I belong to. And so this isn't just a rumor. Crowley actually did bring astrology into to
the
America.
Modern time. Would you consider him more of a magician or an occultist?
Well, to me, they're more or less one in the
one and the same.
Yeah. The you know, physicists, you know, have now demonstrated that an atom can be in two places at the same time. And they've demonstrated that the nature and the behavior of like an electron, you know, is affected by whether or not it's being consciously observed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Today physicists are speculating that nothing really truly exists. Nothing truly occurs unless it's somehow perceived. Okay. And that the ultimate nature of all matter and the nature of energy and space and time and the nature of existence and reality itself is really ultimately consciousness. And that you and I, George, and everyone that's listening tonight, every atom and every subatomic particle and light and matter and all around us, we're all just units of that consciousness. And each of us is that observer. As a unit of consciousness, we're the observer of that drama. That's this big totality of consciousness. And ever since the dawn of human consciousness, shamans and mystics and magicians have been more or less operating under those exact same assumptions. And the only difference between being a modern physicist and a magician is that a physicist is a scientist, and he observes using instruments of measurement. But a magician is an artist and observes, instead of through instruments of measurement, the magician artist observes through like the camera lens of our own liberated imagination. And Crowley describes his magic as being like the method of science and the aim of religion.
Did he have a big following?
He had a tiny following.
Tiny. How did he make a living?
Oh, yeah. In the last years of his life, you know, all of his books, he self-published himself in very, very ornate editions. And he really never made any money. He made a few dollars on his novels, Diary of a Drug Fiend and Moonchild. He made a few bucks off of that. But and he lectured. He would he would lecture. But for many, many years, he lived off of his inheritance from his wealthy father. When his father died,
from his brewery,
I guess. He came into a fortune, and he eventually worked through that. And in the later years of his life, Crowley was truly what they call an undischarged, I think is the term, bankrupt. And he wasn't even in control of his own literary assets or anything else. They belonged to his creditors, but he always seemed to be able to pay his rent, and he always seemed to be able to live in not luxurious circumstances, but quite comfortable.
Had five children, by the way.
Yes, all of different.
Two wives.
Yes. And I've met his grandson, as a matter of fact. Oh, but anyway, his money, it was obvious that his money was coming from a stipend that continued right up until his death.
It was like in a trust for him?
From British intelligence.
Ah, yeah. Oh, they paid him too, huh?
Yeah. Well, that's truly who kept him going in the last years of his life. And he during his life, he never admitted or never blew his own cover, although he hinted for years.
So he was a patriot.
He was He was, absolutely. And you know, the BBC did a poll among the Brits. They took a poll who are the most famous Britons of all time, and they had a list of 500 people that
to choose from.
Yeah, and Crowley was number 72, right between Robert Bruce, you know, Braveheart.
Right, I remember. Robert the Bruce, they called him, right?
Right, Robert the Bruce and Henry V. Crowley's right in the middle there.
Did Crowley like his notoriety?
Loved it.
He relished it, didn't he?
He loved it. And he would be so thrilled that in 2017, 142 years after he was born, there would be people who are now truly starting to appreciate him on the level that he probably thought that he deserved.
And he'd say, my God, there's a national radio show talking about me. Lon, we're going to take a break. Another hour to go, which also includes phone calls. And let's dabble with the occult with some of your calls. We'll be back.